You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Ideas Network is bringing you a documentary podcast series about a little-known process with massive consequences. It's called WPR Reports Mapped Out, and it's a deep dive into redistricting and what it has meant for Wisconsin. In today's bonus episode, WPR's Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson take us through what happened with Wisconsin's redistricting map this year and how we got no map.
Hey, if you're wondering why this popped up in your podcast feed today, let us remind you why we're here.
This is a podcast about redistricting in Wisconsin. It's a process that political parties anticipate every decade. And once it starts, it sometimes feels like it's never going to end.
We started this podcast last September, right before the state legislature introduced its new maps.
And it's been almost 6 months since our last update. 6 months. And a lot of non-redistricting news has happened since then, so maybe we should start with a refresher.
In November, Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature passed their new maps.
A week later, Democratic Governor Tony Evers vetoed them, sending the fight to the state Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court said it would choose a map based on a measure it called least changes. That is, it wanted to make the least changes to the map Republicans drew in 2011.
And that is where we left things. It was kind of tempting to say, game over, Republicans win. All they had to do was submit a least changes map to a conservative Supreme Court. Easy, right?
Other groups submitted their versions of least changes maps. There were maps from Democratic voters, from community groups, from mathematicians. Even the governor submitted a brand new set of maps.
But you know who didn't submit a new map? The legislature. They stuck with the one they passed in the fall, the one that got vetoed.
And it kind of begged the question, why would they do that? Why push ahead with the map that was already rejected by the governor? Why ignore instructions from the state's highest court?
Well, it doesn't matter, because in the end, the strategy would pay off.
From WPR Reports, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. This is Mapped Out.
So like we were saying, the Wisconsin Supreme Court considered maps from a lot of different people. In January, they each had a chance to make their case before the justices.
Good morning on this nice, crisp Wisconsin morning. The case we have on for hearing today is Johnson versus Wisconsin Election Commission et al.
The court met for hours that day, and while they covered a lot of ground, the topic of least changes came up repeatedly. Lawyer after lawyer told justices their map was the most least. They included Anthony Russomano, a State Department of Justice lawyer representing Democratic Governor Tony Evers.
Your Honors, it's undisputed in this litigation that the governor's maps make the least changes to the existing, no matter how you slice it.
Now, we should say here, Russomano is not talking about the map Evers endorsed as part of his People's Maps Commission. That map failed in the legislature, and Evers pretty much abandoned it.
And in its place, drew a new map, one that was clearly designed to meet the court's least change mandate. By the numbers, it moved the fewest people from one district to another. In redistricting speak, its core retention score was the best.
Now, remember, the Republican legislature decided not to submit a new map, one that was drawn specifically with least change in mind. Why not?
The legislature's attorney, Taylor Meehan, got a chance to answer that question in an exchange with Justice Rebecca Dallet. Meehan said, there's different ways of defining least change.
The legislature's plan optimizes population equality, it optimizes municipal splits, and it optimizes least changes.
Right. If it doesn't optimize least change, you have to admit you're not the least change.
No, Your Honor, we fundamentally disagree with that. A least changes measure.
So to sum up, the legislature says it's still a least change map because the population of its districts is closer to equal and it splits fewer municipalities. They say it's okay that they're not the best when it comes to moving people around, to core retention.
But there were signs that the key justice in this case, conservative swing justice Brian Hagedorn, wasn't buying that argument.
So I'm having a hard time understanding why we would now use that standard when that isn't what we told the parties. If we told the parties we wanted you to submit maps that have perfect equality population like the congressional districts, we should have said so, but we didn't say so. We said something quite different, and I don't want to be Charlie Brown and Lucy here.
Charlie Brown and Lucy. You know, the characters from the old Peanuts cartoon.
You just want me to come running up to kick that ball so you can pull it away and see me land flat on my back and kill myself.
This time you can trust me. See? Here's a signed document testifying that I promise not to pull it away.
He gets a running start, and then...
Lucy pulls it away. Charlie Brown goes flying. The rules were changed at the last minute.
Peculiar thing about this document, it was never notarized.
Other conservative justices have no problems with the legislature's argument. They don't see it as Charlie Brown and Lucy. Hagedorn is the tiebreaker. He's the only justice who's unpredictable. If you can persuade him, you have a good chance of winning your case. And about a month and a half after this hearing, Justice Brian Hagedorn does indeed write the majority opinion in Wisconsin's redistricting case.
He's joined by the court's three liberal justices, and this four-justice majority picks the governor's maps. In this game of least changes, Evers has won.
The opinion Hagedorn authors is straightforward. He says the governor's map moves the fewest number of people into new districts, and it's, quote, not a close call.
Hagedorn says the other parties to the case don't offer any other measures of least change that are better than the governor's. He says the governor's assembly map is, quote, vastly superior.
So that's the majority opinion. And at this moment in early March, that opinion is effectively the law of the land in Wisconsin.
The court's other conservative justices disagree. And Justice Patience Rogenczyk says it's her hope that the United States Supreme Court will be asked to review the case.
And they do. They review it. More on that after the break.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to WPR reports mapped out with Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson.
Now, at this point in time, nobody really knows what the U.S. Supreme Court is going to do, because the court doesn't have to do anything. They could just ignore this plea from Wisconsin Republicans like they do with so many other appeals.
But for this case, the U.S. Supreme Court is paying attention. And about 3 weeks after Hagedorn chose the governor's maps, the court steps in and reverses the decision. Evers' victory is short-lived.
Why did the court take such a dramatic step? Because of the Federal Voting Rights Act, the VRA.
Look, we're going to level with you. We find the Voting Rights Act, as it pertains to redistricting, to be complicated. And that's an understatement.
What makes it complicated? Decades of case law, which is not always clearly defined. A lot of math. And what one party says is good for minority voters, another party might say is straight up racist.
When you read Voting Rights Act redistricting decisions, it's easy to get lost in some of the minutiae. You're supposed to start with a three-part test. You consider the totality of the circumstances. VRA cases live and die by this stuff.
And it's not just semantics. There's a reason this law exists in the first place. Marquette University law professor Atiba Ellis is an expert on the VRA.
I think to understand that story, we first have to understand the kind of nature of the racial apartheid that the VRA was designed to fix. And in a way, this takes us all the way back to Reconstruction.
In Ellis's view, a lot of today's political challenges stem from this period in history after the U.S. Civil War. Freed slaves were given rights, but they were incomplete, and new laws were passed that took black people's rights away.
The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed as a response to this, an effort to right the country's wrongs.
So the idea is that the Voting Rights Act allows for minority citizens to fully enjoy participation in the political process.
When it comes to redistricting, the VRA can be used to protect those rights in a couple ways. It can be used as a justification for drawing maps a certain way. Mapmakers can draw more majority-minority districts to ensure minority voters get to elect who they want.
The VRA can also be used after maps are drawn to try to overturn them. If minority voters think they've been packed or cracked by a redistricting plan, they can sue. And courts can and do redraw maps based on these claims.
But whether you're being proactive or reactive, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you have to be careful about when you use the VRA. If you give race too much weight, the court has said, you might violate the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of equal protection, the 14th Amendment.
This is where the U.S. Supreme Court says the Wisconsin Supreme Court got it wrong. The governor's map, the one Brian Hagedorn picked, created an additional majority-minority district in Milwaukee.
Hagedorn said he thought there were good reasons to believe that the district was needed, but his opinion didn't say much about why. Ellis says that was the weakness of Hagedorn's ruling.
What the U.S. Supreme Court basically argued was, look, you didn't walk through these factors in sufficient detail for us to determine whether there was a violation.
In a 7-2 unsigned opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court sent the case back to Wisconsin. Ellis says the court essentially ruled that Hagedorn needed to show his work.
Now, at this point in late March, there's still a chance the governor's plan could prevail. So Evers' lawyers get to work. They tell the Wisconsin Supreme Court they could resubmit their map and show their work this time.
Or they could submit a similar map and only adjust the Milwaukee districts.
The legislature disputes this. They tell the court that the governor shouldn't get another chance.
They say the only answer to this problem is a map that is race neutral, one that doesn't consider race at all.
And who has been saying that their map is race neutral since the beginning? The legislature.
In fact, at the public hearing on the legislature's map, only two people testified in favor, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Republican Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu. And they both stressed a key point about how the maps were drawn.
These employees were instructed not to consider race when drafting the legislative maps.
In hindsight, Voss and LeMahieu chose their words very carefully that day. They were laying the groundwork for when this inevitably went to court.
But Marquette Law's Atiba Ellis sees a troubling trend.
The Voting Rights Act, in and of itself, is about being race conscious.
For Ellis, the worst case scenario is that courts put so much emphasis on race neutrality that the Voting Rights Act itself is declared unconstitutional and its protections for minority voters go away.
But in the short term, the race-neutral argument persuades the Wisconsin Supreme Court. On April 15th, the day candidates for the legislature are scheduled to begin circulating nominating petitions to run in the new districts, the court issues a final decision.
Four justices pick the legislature's map. Brian Hagedorn is one of them. Hagedorn does not write the majority opinion in this ruling, but he does write a short four-page concurrence. He says he didn't think the court's earlier order choosing the governor's maps was based on a Voting Rights Act argument. But once the U.S. Supreme Court said what it said, and with time running out, Hagedorn says the legislature's map was, quote, the remaining option.
University of Wisconsin-Madison law professor and redistricting expert Rob Yablon disputes that.
Even at that late stage, I do think it's an exaggeration to say that there weren't any other options that were available.
Yablon says the Wisconsin Supreme Court could have taken more evidence. They could have reconfigured the Milwaukee districts. They could have drawn a whole new map. These are things courts do, Yablon says.
But instead, the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted the legislature's map wholesale, without changes. The same map that the governor vetoed and the court itself rejected the first time.
After the opinion came out, Yablon analyzed how the final Wisconsin map compared to other court-drawn maps across the country over the past 20 years. He compared them based on several metrics that measure partisanship. He says the maps endorsed by the Wisconsin Supreme Court are in a league of their own.
These maps really stand out as being maps that look exactly like a very strong partisan gerrymander, the kind that you would expect from a legislature which was trying to tilt the playing field in its favor. And of course, that's what this legislature was trying to do. They were trying to reinforce and perpetuate the gerrymander that they had adopted a decade ago. And ultimately, they got the Wisconsin Supreme Court to sign off on that.
But it's not just a carbon copy of the old map. Lines did move. Districts changed. We're not going to walk you through all of the changes, but we can give you one big picture outcome. There's basically no competition under this map.
And to be sure, there wasn't much competition under the old map either. But in some places, despite the best efforts of mapmakers, competition started to bloom. The population changed, people moved, attitudes changed, and seats that were drawn to be safe became competitive. They were suddenly up for grabs.
This new map shut that down. And it's super apparent in one part of the Milwaukee suburbs.
What we are looking at right here is my district runs down 65th Street right here. And then behind us on Clark.
State Representative Robin Vining's Assembly District includes parts of Milwaukee and Waukesha counties. Historically, Waukesha has been hugely important to Wisconsin Republicans, the base of their power.
Vining's district used to be a part of that. For example, in 2014, Democrats didn't even field a candidate here. It was considered safely GOP.
But over the past decade, Milwaukee's suburbs have been changing. Vining, a Democrat, noticed this.
So back in 2018, we had started to notice a crack in the gerrymander.
Vining saw a growing block of Democratic voters in the district, particularly in her home of Wauwatosa. She thought if she could mobilize those voters, she could win the whole district.
And we looked at the math, and we saw that it was in striking distance. We saw it was possible.
And she was able to do something that no other Democrat had done before her under the 2011 map. Robin Vining flipped a district from red to blue, winning by just 138 votes.
Initially, it seemed like Republican leaders viewed Vining's win as a fluke, not indicative of any pattern. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss told Republicans at the state GOP convention in 2019 that Vining's win would be short-lived.
We lost one seat last time to a woman who's going to be a one-termer. I'm not even going to tell you her name because she's going to lose.
It turns out this win wasn't a fluke. In 2020, Vining won by 8 percentage points. Given what people had assumed about the district, it felt like a landslide.
How did Republicans address Robin Vining's district in the 2021 map? They gave it to her.
Under the new map, the Republican legislature's map, Vining's district becomes a safely Democratic seat. President Joe Biden would have won it by 23 percentage points.
How can conceding a seat to a Democrat be a good thing for Republicans? The districts next to Vining's answer that question.
Like the one held by Democrat Sarah Rodriguez. She ran for the legislature in 2020 against a Republican incumbent.
And it was drawn to be a Republican district at the time, but as the 10 years have gone on, the district had changed. And I was able to...
Like Vining, Rodriguez seemingly beat the odds. She flipped the district, winning by just 735 votes. But unlike Vining, Republicans conceded nothing to Rodriguez in the new map.
Where she used to have parts of Milwaukee County, her new district is almost exclusively Waukesha County. By the numbers, it would be tougher for a Democrat to win here.
And by doing all of that, they also protected a Republican Senate seat that was trending Democratic.
Now that the legislature's map is final, what will elections look like?
Out of 99 assembly districts, only 3 are projected to be within 2 percentage points. Only 3. The rest have basically been decided before a single vote is cast.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden
and Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand and digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
That's right, more at wpr.org/mappedout or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show, and news update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of a food tradition from a Caribbean island.
Cooking can transport us to another place, another time. When we cook, we're able to keep our family's dishes and memories alive for generation after generation. That's the case for Anne Marie Herman in Madison, who was raised on the island of St. Lucia. WPR's L. Malik Anderson brings us her story about fish cakes. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
The smell of hot oil, jerk chicken, and freshly baked bread with coconut and chocolate chips fill Anne Marie Herman's kitchen in Madison. She heats up the oil in a large, heavy cast iron pan over her stovetop. Her ingredients wait on the countertop, ready to be put to work.
This is flour. This is the codfish. It has thyme, onion, garlic, and other spices.
On the menu today, salted fish cakes. She fills the frying pan with as many battered fish cakes as she can at once. After they are all done, she takes them out of the pan and places them on top of a huge pile of more fish cakes. This dish has been a part of Herman's life for a long time.
I was born in the Caribbean islands, St. Lucia. But when I was much younger, I used to cook for my older brothers. That's how I started cooking, real cooking.
Herman grew up in the countryside with her mother and would go back and forth to the middle of the town to cook for her elder brothers who were taxi drivers.
My brothers were taxi drivers who were in the middle of town driving tourists and stuff, so they don't have time to do anything with cooking. So I used to do the cooking for them. But what my trick was not using a lot of fat in my food. I didn't used to measure a lot of stuff when I was cooking.
Herman started keeping track of her measurements for each dish when she decided to publish a cookbook of family favorite recipes with a Caribbean twist.
You see inside of it? It has all the Caribbean islands in there. That's my idea of putting the Caribbean foods together.
In her cookbook, she shares recipes for beef patties, fried green plantains, aloha friendship bread. There's also jerk chicken and other dishes her family enjoys.
Fish cakes is another thing I make often. You take codfish, you boil it because it has a lot of sodium in it. So you wash it first, then you put it in a little pot to boil. And then when you give it a few minutes to cook, when it softens, you wash it again. You put more cold water on it to take the salt. Then you shred it and you add spices to it.
She said her fish cakes are always a hit among her friends in the Caribbean Association of Madison.
Sometimes I even try to hide it, but they find it before the meal. And some people will come and say, where is the fritters? They call it fritters. They ask me, where are the fritters you brought? It's there, but when you look, It's gone.
Saint Lucia, Helen of the West.
WPR producer El Malik Anderson brought us that story on Anne Marie Herman's Fish Cakes. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now to the shortage of CNAs in Wisconsin, certified nursing assistants. A state workforce development program called WIS Caregiver Careers aims to add upwards of 3,000 nurse aides to the workforce, filling vacant positions in Wisconsin nursing homes. Maybe you're a CNA, maybe in training to become one, or you work for a healthcare organization that relies heavily on nursing assistants in its care model. 800-642-1234 to join in. John Vandermeer is spokesperson for the Bay Health and Rehabilitation Centers in Wisconsin, one of the employers participating in the WIS Caregiver Careers Program. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thanks, Kate. Great to be on.
Good morning. Kate Battiato is here as well, Director of Workforce Development for the Wisconsin Healthcare Association. Kate, welcome to you.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, good morning, Kate. Let's start with you. The Wisconsin Hospital Association reported out numbers earlier this year that our healthcare workforce experienced unprecedented vacancy rates last year, CNAs having the biggest workforce gaps, other frontline staff as well. How is the state trying to address this?
Well, WIS Caregiver Careers is one way that we're addressing it. I'm so happy to announce that Governor Evers has invested $6 million in WIS Caregiver Careers to open up an additional 3,000 training slots statewide. WIS Caregiver Careers provides free CNA training, free certification testing, and $500 caregiver bonuses. And we're seeking to encourage new workers to enter the field of caregiving by lowering the cost of becoming a CNA and by making training more readily accessible.
So that $6 million, for the most part, is being put toward the training costs to train up a CNA?
That's correct. We are going to be providing that free training, free certification testing, and $500 caregiver bonuses. The program has always paid for the free training and testing, and with our new upcoming expansion, the program will now also pay the $500 caregiver bonus. We're also adding a new feature to the program, which is peer-to-peer mentoring. We'll be providing resources and support targeted at three different stakeholder groups, nursing home leadership, the mentors, and the mentees, to all help them get the most of the opportunity. And we're also able to provide the mentors a $500 bonus for each mentee who achieves six-month job retention. And we're doing this because we want to appreciate and acknowledge the work that our current CNA workforce is doing to develop and retain our new CNA workforce.
I'm going to get back to that $500 retention bonus in a moment. But, John, you represent the Bay Health and Rehabilitation Centers in Wisconsin, participating in this WIS Caregiver Careers Program. How is the program making an impact on your operations?
So the Bay Health and Rehabilitation Centers are proud to be participants in the WIS Caregiver Career Program. And what the WIS Caregiver Career Program does for our facilities is it allows us to have a framework several different ways to recruit, train, and retain CNAs into the profession. One of the things about being a CNA is I've heard it described as the toughest job that you'll ever love. And in the job of being a CNA, you can really make more than a living, you can make a difference. And so what this is, the program tries to do is bring people into the profession, make sure that they receive the necessary training to be effective in the profession and meet regulatory compliance of being a CNA, and then retains them in the profession over the long haul by providing the necessary tools and resources that they need to stay in the profession. So with the significant the significant caregiver shortage, the WISC Caregiver Career Program is a critical component to addressing that.
What are vacancies looking like at Bay Health right now?
So, I mean, I think that we have done whatever we have been able to try and be a part of the solution in terms of addressing the workforce shortage. We're actively, working on the recruiting side. We're actively trying to make flexible work schedules, competitive pay, and active monitoring of employee feedback. But I mean, it is certainly a tough time out there generally with the Great Resignation and with workforce shortages generally. But we feel that the opportunities that are afforded CNAs give them an opportunity to really make a difference in the lives of older adults. And with a partnership with the WISC Caregiver Career Program, we believe that there are real opportunities to address aspects of this workforce shortage.
But do you see the open positions, especially in the area of CNAs, is it growing? Is it reducing? Is it stagnating? Like, where are you at?
I think that it continues to exist as a challenge. Certainly, Wisconsin and the Bay Health and Rehabilitation Centers are no exception. This is a national trend that facilities are facing across the country in senior living. I think that what Wisconsin is doing very effectively, I think, is creating a national model with the WISC Caregiver Career Program and providing innovative solutions to address the challenges of the workforce shortage. I think that with this important funding that Governor Evers and Secretary Timberlake are advancing, I think that this will continue to keep the workforce shortage on the front burner. And we have to continue to engage in active experimentation to see whatever we can do to address this using innovative policy solutions.
Yes, and I think, Kate, I want to toss this back to you because I think John brings up a really great tension. You know, how much fiscal responsibility should private companies shoulder that run these long-term care facilities? How much responsibility should they have in providing a livable wage and retaining employees versus what the government is kicking in to prop up the frontline healthcare industry that is in distress?
Well, Medicaid rates, reimbursement rates are astoundingly low when it comes to worker training. And that's why we are so happy about this $6 million investment from the Evers administration. We've within the next few weeks, our 2022 workforce report will be published. And I can give you and your listeners a little sneak peek of what our results are. According to our survey, the median offered hourly wage to certified nursing assistants is now reported at $15 an hour. But still, our respondents are reporting that they have no applicants for open positions and no call, no shows for interviews and shifts, and an inability to compete with non-healthcare employers. And that's why with Caregiver Careers, we're really trying to invest in our employers' abilities to recruit across this very competitive healthcare labor market.
We're talking about the outsized need for certified nursing assistants in Wisconsin. Kate Battiato there, Workforce Development Director for the Wisconsin Healthcare Association. John Vandermeer with us represents the Bay Health and Rehabilitation Centers in Wisconsin. Join in on CNA training, CNA pay, retention, the future of the CNA workforce, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing efforts to expand the number of certified nursing assistants in Wisconsin, upwards of 3,000 this summer. At the start of the year, remember, Governor Evers mobilized the National Guard, asking dozens of troops to become CNAs as the Omicron variant surged, healthcare staffing shortages intensified. Join in on CNA staffing where you are, 800-642-1234. Kate Battiato is Workforce Development Director for the Wisconsin Healthcare Association. John Vandermeer, spokesperson for the Bay Health and Rehabilitation Centers. They're with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Tina joining us from Green Bay. Tina, hi. I understand you're a nurse.
I am. I am a nurse. I've been a nurse for about 15 years, and I started as a CNA when I was going through school. You had to be a CNA first, so I did that, and I worked as a CNA as I was going through nursing school, and that's still the system still works that way. Generally, in nursing school, a lot of young people or returning adults will become CNAs, but those are just jobs that are temporary for them, and, you know, they're looking for the next best job, and even our CNAs that, you know, are coming into the workforce maybe a little bit older that are going to be a CNA, they're always looking for the next best paying job. And that's the whole issue. Pay is way too low. We have such a terrible federal, the standard rate for federal pay is so low. And we say, well, if you're making $12 or $15 an hour, that's way above minimum wage. But really, it's not a living wage. $15 is not a living wage if you're an adult trying to raise a family and have a mortgage and that. So you are always going to have this issue because CNAs are always going to be looking for the next best job. And it's such an important job, and you work with such a fragile clientele, and it's just a shame that the people who do the hardest work get paid the less.
Tina, thank you so much for that. And Kate, you know, looking even at the Bureau of Labor Statistics I did this morning, nationwide mean hourly wage of a nursing assistant is $16 an hour nationwide. So how big of an issue is low wages?
It's a huge issue, and it is all so tightly connected with Medicaid reimbursement rates. Until we can really get some reform in that, I don't see how providers can offer better wages. I think our provider community has really acknowledged that there are barriers to employment when it comes to both becoming a CNA and staying a CNA. And with Caregiver Careers, addresses one of those barriers, and that's access and affordability of training. And the fact that the employers want to take that the lead in removing that barrier is a huge step forward.
John, what is your take on wages when, you know, CNAs are on par with the average starting salary in retail, but you need more skills and training to be a CNA?
Yeah, no question. So I think that in order for long-term care facilities and skilled nursing facilities to be in a position to compete with the Walmarts, the Quick Trips, the McDonald's, the Starbucks, we have to be in a situation where we get paid that the facility ends up receiving adequate reimbursement for the care and services that they provide to the community that they serve. So with Medicaid reimbursement in Wisconsin, there's been significant losses sustained for every skilled nursing facility resident that's provided care through the Medicaid program. Two-thirds of all skilled nursing facility residents in the state of Wisconsin are on the Medicaid program, and facilities lose
about $70 a day for every Medicaid resident that they serve. And this translates into approximately $1 million loss for each facility just on the basis of that cost center. And skilled nursing facilities have a mission. They want to provide care and services to older adults. That's what we do, regardless of payment source. But if we're starting out $1 million in the hole, that makes it difficult to maintain competitive wage structures compared to, convenience stores and big box retailers and gas stations out there. We can't raise the price of a Big Mac or a latte or, something like that. We our ability to provide care is reflective of the reimbursement that our facilities received. So I think that Governor Evers and the legislature have done important work in this direction, but there's still more work to be done.
Let's go to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay, go ahead.
Hello, good morning. I'd like to talk about testing. When you take the test for CNA, you can test on the job. You can get paid by the CEO corporation of the long-term care facility, okay, like we used to. They had in-service meetings. You got paid to go to them. That's extra training, okay, things you need to be trained in. You got to be updated in all the time, like CPR and other things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is most of the facilities need evening hours. Our buses only run till midnight. The buses that are on the routes of the nursing homes, they don't even run.
Oh, that's
so transportation is the problem, too.
Such interesting, great points, Mary Kay, and we're short on time. Kate, I'm going to toss this to you. Pay to train and transportation.
Two humongous barriers to employment that the provider community, the employer community, has to absorb. It's workforce development policy is really where the rubber meets the road, where all these policy issues combine. And if the transportation policy isn't there, if the training policy isn't there, the workforce isn't there.
Mm. And so tell me very quickly here, what does success look like with the WISC Caregiver Careers Program? When, what is incrementally getting to that 3,000 number?
Well, first off, we want to get our employers signed up and ready to go. We've had some great success with employer outreach across the state. We have over 200 employers signed up to participate. So that's a huge milestone right there. We will be kicking off our statewide media campaign, which will encourage the public to consider careers in long-term care. Harkening back to your first caller about career pathways up from a CNA, one thing that healthcare can offer.
And only have 10 seconds.
Just the career pathways up.
Yeah.
It doesn't end as a CNA. You have a lot of options moving up.
Thank you both for joining us. Kate Battiato, Director of Workforce Development for the Wisconsin Healthcare Association. John Vandermeer, spokesperson for the Bay Health and Rehabilitation Centers in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.